Good morning and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran and welcome to have you here today. We've got a great guest, and we're going to be talking about some major announcements that's been made in the podcasting space and kind of dissect those a little bit. But good morning, Rob, my co-host, Rob Greenlee. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's great as always to be here talking about podcasting. It's, Todd, all three of us, it's our life every day, full time. So it's there's always a lot going on, that's for sure. And it's sunny in Seattle. I can't complain.
Yeah. So one thing I want to do, go ahead and introduce our guest, Rob.
Yeah. The guest that we have on has been on the show before. His name is Andy Bowers, who runs the podcasting. He's like chief content officer for Slate. And has been running a fantastic podcast network had some big announcements this past week around a much larger effort around kind of bringing more podcast content to the space. And we wanted to have him on to talk about the really cool stuff that he's doing with podcasting. And welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Todd. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you guys have been getting some pretty good buzz over the past few days about your guys' announcement. Why don't you tell us what the effort is with the announcement with the Panoply? I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Panoply.fm.
Panoply, yes.
Yeah.
We've many people even on our team are calling it Panoply, which sounds like a fun game, but that O is not there. It's Panoply, which many of us had to look up. It means a complete or impressive collection of things, and that's exactly what we're trying to do. We've put together a larger network, slightly to the side of Slate, in which we can bring in new partners, primarily at first media organizations, some authors, thought leaders, but we decided to start with the printed word space, which is the one that we come from, that we're most comfortable with. So our launch partners include the New York Times Magazine, New York Magazine, Real Simple, Inc. Magazine, Popular Science, The Huffington Post, author Gretchen Rubin. Thank you. You're showing so I can remind myself what's there. About Race, that podcast, which we're going to launch in April with Baratunde Thurston and a few other folks. Food 52, the website dedicated to food from Amanda Hesser, who used to be at the New York Times. The idea is to enable other media organizations to start making podcasts. Those that already have podcasts, including the Huffington Post, are welcome in. We'll do ad sales for them. We'll help bolster their podcast by putting them in the network and doing a lot of cross promotion. Those who don't currently produce podcasts, we're offering production services as well as the other parts of being a member of the network. And we hope it's going to expand podcasting quite a bit.
One person in the chat room said, I thought this was like Podcast Monopoly.
Ka-ching, ka-ching. Huh?
No.
I don't aspire to that. We like the competition.
Yeah.
So, last time we talked, of course, about the effort that was going on at Slate and everything that was going there. What was the, what was the genesis of you guys deciding to kind of, for a better word, go large, or go wider? What was the thought behind that?
Primarily, podcasting has been such a boon to Slate. It has expanded the awareness of the magazine. It has brought our editors and writers into a different part of the public sphere and given the magazine a literal voice in addition to the figurative voice that any magazine has. And we realized that there were a lot of people out there who could be making interesting audio as well who weren't currently, and we thought we knew who some of them were. And so we wanted to give people more interesting stuff to listen to. There's also a business play behind this, which is, as you well know, Todd, and I'm sure you know as well, Rob, getting to scale is very important for advertisers. We've had advertising in our podcast for 10 years now, and our team has learned a lot about the unique sphere of selling podcast advertising. Like most podcasts, we do a lot of direct response advertisers, the kind who, it's a direct call to listeners to go to a website, buy a particular product. But we've also had a lot of success with larger brand advertisers at Slate, often selling them as part of a larger package. And we feel like we can do even more of this, especially if we have more programming in a similar vein that will be friendly to brand advertisers and great for listeners. You know, when what we want to do for the listener is alleviate what I call the cul-de-sac problem, where you get to the end of a podcast and then you're stuck. You don't know where to go next. You have to go back and search, figure out what the next thing is. We want to give people an obvious place to go, similar but not identical programming of equal quality and equal interest.
You know, one thing that you know, Rob and I have been talking about quite a bit is that this year is really going to be, and I saw this before, is going to be a content play. There's going to be, I guess for a better word, it's the battle, and let's use in literal terms, the battle for the top 5% of the shows that are out there, and the attempt to build new shows, to build new volume. You see it happening at Podcast One. You see it happening with the mid-roll folks. You know, they're all, you know, someone sent me an email the other day and said, hey, I can't work with such and such company again or anymore because they've upped the bar on, you know, what they require for, you know, minimum show size. So, you know, I think, you know, a thing I'm worried about, and Andy, this is something you guys are going to have to deal with. And, you know, obviously you've got great partners already, so that's going to help launch you guys a lot. But do you feel there's going to be this ongoing back and forth of a battle to sign and retain, you know, top shows?
Perhaps. I mean, the shows in our network are independent. You know, when you work with the New York Times, you know, they own their show. It's their personnel on the show. And they, you know, it's their deal. So is that possible? Sure. Yeah. There's going to be competition for the top talent, but I feel as though if we give people a good experience, if being part of the network is a benefit, then they'll stay with us. And so far it's working out really well. We've been able to give a good launch to a number of brand new programs. They're doing extremely well. We have a lot more in the pipeline, and I like our chances, but yeah, there's going to be a lot of competition. In general, though, you know, you mentioned Midroll, Podcast One, there's Gimlet, there's a number of other networks starting up now. I still feel like the penetration of podcast in the American public and around the world is still so low that there are huge opportunities still. Every listener that another network brings in is a listener who could also come and listen to my programs. And every listener I bring in is one who could start listening to the other networks as well. I think it is a win-win at this point. You know, when we get to the point where everyone is listening to podcasts, Then we're just trying to pull listeners from one another. Well, then the competition will get real. But I think we're many years away from that.
Yeah, I think, Todd, let me ask one thing. The trend line that I've seen is that earlier in the podcast kind of development, a lot of networks popped up very focused on a specific genre.
Yeah.
And what I'm seeing starting to evolve now are networks that are forming that have a variety of content in them. So they're more like what has been done in TV and other areas of media for a long time, where there's a variety of genres that are covered in the content. So I think as I look at your selection of shows, it spans the whole spectrum, right? From news to political to the entertainment area, and I think that's the key to building a successful network in the long run. And I think it's a healthy sign for the whole podcasting industry that networks are starting to form that can feel like they can do that and not have to specialize so much in a particular genre of content. You know, if it's tech or if it's politics or whatever, that expansion can happen.
I agree. Certainly, we are trying to, we're venturing into a lot of different genres. You're right.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that I think a more narrowly focused network could also succeed. You know, ESPN is pretty focused on sports, and they do really well. 5x5 has its corner of the market as well, and they do well from what I can tell. So I don't think that's the only way to go, but that is what we're going to explore. We feel like we have a great audience. We feel like they have wide interests. I'm talking about the original Slate audience, of course, now. And we're hoping to give them more to listen to, quality programs that may bring them to different genres. And we want to explore what works for us. It's still very, very early in podcasting, as you both know. And I think we're going to find what works for us, what works for our audience. But part of that is exploring different genres. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, because as you pull in even new genres of content, you're going to reach another segment of a potential listener that may not have been attracted to podcasting in the past. And I think we've seen these spurts that have happened around comedy and then politics and sports. And each time those have grown and developed, there's been an expansion, I think, of listenership.
Absolutely. 100% agree. And we're going to do our part to continue the trend.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I saw in the early days, you guys at Slate have obviously had your core group there for a long time. But, when I saw in the early days that the challenge with networks, and I built a couple myself, was that you really have to have, and this is really the key to the success, you have to have some linchpins. You look at Leo at Twit. Mm-hmm. You have certain linchpins that help really kind of rise the rest of the shows to the top. And without a few linchpin shows, it's very, very hard to get the volume you need. You can have a whole bunch of shows, but it's hard to build volume. I know when we were building TPN, I think we got up to like 140 or 150 shows, and some come and go and news come in. But one thing I've watched the numbers over the years on that network on the volume standpoint, and the volume stayed pretty steady, about 11 million, maybe to 12 million listens per month out of, those core shows. But there was a group, there's a group of 20 there that carry the majority of the network over. Are you guys seeing then, Andy, on your guys' shows, are you seeing the kind of the same kind of trend? You have some really big shows, and then the rest of the shows are, obviously you got some high profile stuff, so your number, your baseline number is going to be higher to begin with. But what do you see there? Do you see the same type of, I guess for better words, design or trend?
Well, yeah, sure. Some of our shows do better than others. In general, the ones that have been around the longest have had the most time to build up audiences. We've launched some new shows recently that are doing extremely well. But it's not, the volume is not the only measure of how successful they are.
That's true.
We introduced about a year and a half ago a parenting show called Mom and Dad Are Fighting. And it has a strong audience, but it's not as big as some of our more established shows. Yet, it does really well with advertisers. There's, particular advertisers who are interested in reaching parents. And so, that show is a complete success from a business point of view and doesn't need the same volume because it has the great advertiser interest. There's going to be a sorting process, certainly. There are going to be some shows that shoot to the top and others that lag behind. I want to give things a chance. I don't want to become like a TV network executive who pulls something after two episodes because it's not working. I want everything to have a chance to build and find its audience. And if that means supporting them from the shows that are more successful, I'm happy to do that. But, there will be a sorting at some point. We'll reassess and say, is this really working? Could we do something that works better?
Yeah, and Todd, I think to really kind of answer your question, Slate is that anchor for
this.
I mean, it's the core of where this network came from, I believe. That's true, I'm sure.
Yes. I mean, Slate is one partner in Panoply, and I'm going to not play favorites, even though I started all of these shows at Slate.
Yeah.
But, we're going to use our shows to promote other shows. We're going to introduce the existing audience to the new shows, especially the ones that are related to the particular show that we're talking on. But, you know, it is one partner, and we want to make sure that every partner in the network feels and is treated equally.
You know, Andy, I think that a delta here that is going to work in your guys' favors, you know, you've been in the space 10 years and you understand what it takes to get a show from point A to point B. You know, I got a call, it's probably been a couple of weeks, from a guy, and he was, you know, quite frustrated. He was on, basically had brought on a network. They gave him 90 days to prove himself. And after 90 days, they bounced him. And, you know, we talked about his numbers, and he was doing really, really well. And I was flabbergasted that, you know, he'd only been given 90 days to prove himself. And that to me just smells badly of old school way of thinking. And, you know, after we talked quite a bit, he felt pretty good. And, you know, I'm watching the guy's show, and he's doing well on his own, and he's going to, you know, he's going to have a huge audience. But, you know, the podcast stuff grows at a different, you know, obviously you're going to have the shows that are going to go straight up, you know, it's, you know, like Slate and those folks, you know, they definitely have got this, you know, this effect that happens, but, you know, that doesn't happen very often. It's usually, you know, consistent hammering away, building an audience, doing the things you got to do to reach out, you know, all that stuff, you know, and, you know, I always tell guys, give your shows, you know, and maybe, you know, I know from a business perspective, if you can afford to give a show 2 years. But, you know, everybody I work with personally that, you know, even I signed to my little mini network at Geek News Central, you know, it's a 2-year run. Let's go for 2 years and see how you do. You know, my financial impact is not nearly as big as it would be for folks like you. But I just think, you know, this someone giving someone 90 days is not enough.
Well, Todd, yeah, I think that the reason that happens is that oftentimes those shows are staffed with producers and people that are paid to actually work on those shows. And if they don't perform, then, you know, it is that same thing that we were talking about, is that, you know, kind of like the TV studios, it's a cost factor, and that's why it happens. I mean, it's not, I mean, sometimes I think it happens a little too quickly for some shows, and that's what inspires some shows to change networks, right? Let's say it didn't work on this network, but maybe we move over to this other network that doesn't have as much costs behind making the show, and the hosts have to take on more responsibility of actually doing more of the pre-production and post-production, and then maybe they do a deal with an independent guy that actually does the ad sales for them, and they can make more money, and it's a much more efficient operation too. So I think that there's a lot of business factors that go into why that happens to shows. But I agree, a 90-day window is a pretty short window. But I've actually seen stuff get canceled quicker than that.
You know, let's be honest. You know, 90 days in the podcasting space is not enough. You know, it just isn't, in my opinion. And the cost, you know, I have to laugh when people talk about cost of production for podcasting. You know, I guess, I look at it a different way. I look at it from an independent content creator, and there is relatively no cost. You know, I also don't think necessarily a show has to be highly produced to be successful. It probably helps a lot. But I don't know, Andy, what do you think about, you know, what would you consider? And I don't want to put you on the spot here, because, you know, but what do you think it's going to take to time wise? What would you give a show?
there is no particular number. I'm not going to be pinned down on.
Right. Didn't want to do that.
We're keeping the network relatively small. We're not taking anyone who wants to come aboard for exactly that reason. I don't want to have to disappoint people. So we're, you know, we're thinking long and hard before we invite someone to join the network or respond to their request to join the network. We're, as you can see from the list of people, we're working with organizations or authors who already have established audiences, and right, hoping that we can convert those readers into listeners and expand the pool for Panoply to start with, and podcasting in general. But, you know, outside of what we're doing, you talk about the highly produced shows. I can see that being a much bigger problem for those, because, you know, if you're going to spend the money as you would on a cereal or something like that, and it wasn't that kind of massive hit, that would be a lot of money. Luckily for cereal, it was, you know, the biggest hit. But, you know, there are people who are probably going to venture into that space and not have the success of that, but spend a lot of money producing it. And I can see more of an argument for pulling the plug early on something like that if it's not mm-hmm. working, because you'll be out a lot of money if you produce episode right. after episode of that highly, highly produced content.
Yeah.
I think what we need to make sure that probably the majority of the content creators that are listening to this show understand is don't get disenfranchised. You know, that the big shows are coming in. We need the big shows. We need big, big successful shows. We need more of them. You know, more successful shows we have, the better the space is going to be. You know, what we need is we need, you know, 10 articles a day coming out about the podcasting space and talking about 10 different shows and 10 different genres. And when that happens, then we'll, I guess for a better word, we'll truly jump the shark and we'll have come of age. I think we're pretty close of coming at age at this point based on way my phone's been ringing lately, but it is interesting to watch the advertising space changing too. I don't want to go too much into that, but kind of focus on the content today. How has been the you know, from working with your partners, how's their response been, and what is their general sentiment? Do you hear it, a theme coming from folks?
Well, one reason that I've been able to keep going at Slate all these years, including through the depths of the recession, is that people love to do the podcasts. Our flagship show, The Political Gabfest, which has been going for more than 9 years now, that's hosted by David Plotz, who was the editor of Slate, and includes Emily Bazelon, who was our legal correspondent. Both of them have left Slate, but the one connection they kept was doing the podcast because they enjoy it so much. And, you know, I've talked to our partners and said, I think that your people will feel this too, that they'll enjoy it. They'll love the engagement of the audience, which, as you guys know, is second to none, even on the internet, even with blogs and things like that. The podcasting audience is engaged. They're passionate. They are fun to talk to and engage with. And so there's a real benefit to the people doing the podcast. There's a benefit to the organization. And so far, I think that all of our partners are having a really good time. We're helping those who don't have their own production facilities to do it. We have a really good content creation system in place now. We're growing the number of studios we have. We're growing the number of freelance producers who can work on these, who have experience and can make it an easy process for the partners coming in. And, you know, all reports I've heard so far is that people are really enjoying it and they're enjoying the feedback they're getting.
I think that's, you know, that is saying something there, because I've always said if I quit having fun doing my show, you know, it doesn't matter how much money I'm making, I'm not going to do it no more. It becomes a chore. And I think the majority of us that are content creators are, this is fun. This is fun stuff to do. Yeah. So it makes a lot of sense. And the thrill of being able to help people, give information, you know, that's really, that's core of what this space is about.
Well, Todd, and I think also it's really a good sign too, because I think there are a lot of people out there that are very talented and very good at connecting with people and large audiences that maybe don't want to dive into the technical and more kind of mundane work that comes in to play when you produce a podcast, as we all know. It's not always fun to get a podcast out the door. It's fun to record it, and it's fun to prepare for it, and it's fun to do a lot of aspects of it, but there's also a lot of tough work that goes into making a show every week. And to have a staff or have a producer work on your show, and I saw this at, you know, at Podcast One, it's very helpful to certain types of talent. They kind of expect that. But that does come with a cost. And I think that kind of dovetails back to what we were just talking about earlier, is that, I think it's a good sign that more and more shows are getting a producer, and they're getting, that means that there's revenue coming in to support this and to pay people. And I think it's definitely a, it's a positive trend line, you know, overall, because it's difficult, as you know, Todd, and I did the same thing, you know, producing your own show, doing all the post-production, do the pre-production. Yeah. And having, you know, your own studio and all stuff. I mean, a lot of these people that we're talking about are just people that are doing other things in their careers.
Yeah.
They just want to go into a studio, record their show, maybe do some guest booking, and that's about it, you know, and then they go off and do their careers.
You know, one thing with, I have to relate a story. It was probably 3 or 4 years ago. We were at NAB, and it was right during the time when the set-top box stuff was really kicking off, and we were doing, you know, promoting a lot of video and working with Roku and stuff. And, you know, I had this guy come up to the booth, and he's like, oh, you guys are doing this and that and this and that. He says, I've got a production company, and we'll produce, we can do 30-minute video products for you guys. It's $20,000 an episode. And I'm internally I'm laughing, because if this guy only knew, you know, you know, if he only knew. And I, you know, politely, thank you very much, took his card and stuff. But there is this difference in the world. When you're in the broadcasting side, there is, you know, lots of zeros behind production. And when you're mostly in the podcasting world, there's a couple of zeros maybe behind production, you know. So we still have quite the gap to fill. And I think, as you said, Rob, as the money comes in, maybe that'll change. But I still to this day laugh when I think about that guy coming in and telling me he'd produce 30 minutes of video for $20,000. I'm thinking to myself, we're going to be here with Andy for about 60 minutes, and you and I will continue a bit longer, but, you know, produce this show $45,000. And I'm just like, yeah, right. It's not going to happen. So.
Yeah. Can I make a add-on point about this, which is that one trend I do see going on in podcasting is increasing professionalism, not in the sense that people are making tons more money, but in that the sound is getting better. And that to me is really important. Mm-hmm. That has been an important point for me from the beginning of what we do, is that, you know, there is nothing more intimate than being in someone's eardrum.
Right.
And I think podcasting can be done extremely cheaply, extremely efficiently. I don't think there's any excuse, though, for assaulting a listener's ears. And there are very simple things that you can do, even with not expensive equipment, to make it sound better. But, you know, to have a big echoey room, or popping your microphone all the time, or, you know, being overmodulated, all of these things can be fixed with the right expertise. And I think that is becoming a sorting mechanism that people, listeners may not even realize that that's why they're turning against something. But I think that that is something that's standing in the way of success for a lot of podcasters. Many people who have interesting things to say, important topics that they cover. But if the sound quality isn't there, I think you're going to lose audience very quickly.
There's probably a reason why, from the very, very beginning, I invested heavily in equipment. And I know a lot of podcasters don't. They don't have the budget for it. But for me, it was really important in the early days that I get the sound that I wanted. And I'm... You know, it's always a work in progress, but I think I'm probably 90% there after 1,000+ episodes. But there's a reason why I use a $1,400 mic. You know, there's a reason why I have the stack of gear. Now, most folks can't afford that, and there's great cheaper alternatives. But I agree with you, getting the sound way you want it and make it sound good is really, really, it's critical.
But you don't even... I mean, you can have all the expensive equipment in the world. If you don't use it right,
right,
it makes no difference whatsoever. And you can have a fairly cheap setup and use it well, and you'll be just fine.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not always a question of money. It's a question of technique.
Yeah.
Skill. And then another aspect of it, you know, is what is actually delivered to the listener too. And that's, you know, what is the bit rate? What's the encoding? How good a quality is the... audio. I know a lot of people record their podcast directly into an MP3, and then they pull it into an editor, and then they re-encode it. I mean, Andy, that gets back to what you were talking about. It's skills in production and skills in optimizing what that audio quality actually in post-production turns out to be as well, and what you're delivering to that listener in their feed. I mean, is it 128K, which I see more and more podcasts moving towards 128K. You know, there's still a lot of podcasts out there and networks that push 64K. And I think that gets back really to the core of what you're saying, Andy. I mean, it depends on what the network looks at as far as what they want to invest in bandwidth and if bandwidth is even an issue. I know for some podcasts, folks, bandwidth is an issue. For others, it's not. It depends on where you host it. But it feels like 128K is now the standard. And so what is Slate and your podcast using? Are you guys 96 or 128, or what are you using, Andy?
We're 80 at the moment.
80?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hmm. And we have been 64.
Okay.
So, I'm still considering that. The only reason we aren't 128 is that it's not our bandwidth, it's the listener's bandwidth that I'm concerned about. People who listen over cell connections, things like that. There is some anxiety about people using up their data. And when they see a really big file, I think they run screaming. I don't want to make them run screaming. But I notice some mistakes as simple as people put out a stereo file for a mono show. I mean, there's almost no stereo content in there, so there's no reason to use stereo, and it simply doubles the size of the file. Yep. They could get much better sound with the same file size if they made it mono. And these kinds of mistakes, you know, I think just hurt the podcaster.
Yeah, and I mean, on that point, that's a really good point. I mean, I've been really encouraging folks, if you're going to do stereo, do joint stereo, because that's going to be the most file efficient way of getting kind of the effect of stereo without the full file size. And then, I mean, really, I think a sweet spot is 96K, actually. 80 is much better than 64. It sounds better, definitely. But I've been, you know, I kind of see most people are 96, 128 now. But I definitely see your point. I mean, I'm not in favor of 64K. I think it's a little hollow sounding.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, one thing that I did is, everyone needs a tune-up from time to time, too. And luckily, I have a good friend who lives in New York. It's Paul Figiani. Most of you guys probably know Paul. He worked with Doug Kay a lot before, and now he really, he's basically, in my opinion, he's an audio guru. And, you know, he emailed me maybe 3-4 months ago, and he's like, dude, we need to talk. And, you know, basically we emailed back and forth a few times, and there was just some things that had kind of slipped here a little bit. And we went through and made the tweaks, and I did some sample recordings, and he, you know, tore it apart. And he didn't even have to be here. And within a couple of days, had things kind of back in line where it needed to be. And I was, I got comments from the audience. Hey, what did you do? You made a tweak. Things sound better. And, you know, I think what happens is when we get into this, and just for content creators on general, you know, you need to be looking at your rig about every, every whip stitch and make sure that, way it sounded when you got it set up is still sounding the way it is. Because, you know, we don't move those pots and we don't change things, but gear changes over time and you need to make tweaks. And,
You never know. I mean, Todd, I had a small thing happen, like my cat walked across my mixer, and he accidentally stepped on some buttons. So, those things can happen and you just don't know about it. Yeah.
You know, and it's like when the kids, it's true. When I had young kids, that was like, I had to put a sheet over the top of the mixer because they would come in there and they'd want to. And what really ended up solving it was I took a picture of it so that I knew exactly where everything was set. But, that's when you're working in your house. If you're working in a studio, you don't have that issue. But,
it's probably good to put a sheet over your mixer because it keeps dust from getting on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also a big fan of editing. We have a lot of shows that are panel discussion shows, and people think that they aren't edited, but actually some of them are quite highly edited. We try to make them sound as natural as possible, but I come from radio. I was at NPR for 20 years. When I started in podcasting, everything was very short. Everything was really tightly done because I was used to working to a clock. And the freedom of podcasting is there is no clock. You can go as long as you want. But that puts a responsibility on you as a producer to make sure that things are exactly as long as they should be and not 1 second longer. You know, it doesn't give you a license to waste people's time. And I think that good editing can be a really big boon to a podcast.
You know, I'll be the first to admit I run counter to that school of thought, and there's okay. there's a reason for it, Andy. And I understand in your guys' situation you have to. I don't take this the wrong way, but I think the reason we have such a high failure rate, why we lose so many shows, why so many shows start and then die, is because they get wrapped around the axle of editing, and they spend more time editing than they do producing content, and they become frustrated and pissed off, and they say, this is for the birds, I'm out of here. And so my philosophy has always been, if you know, create the content, do the best you can in a quick post edit, and get in and get out. It'll get better over time. Now, is that the right philosophy? Maybe not, but it's mine. And I think that when I hear people are spending 4, 5, 6 hours post editing a 30-minute program, I'm like, how? First of all, how do you do that? And you know, I would be divorced. So, you know, if you're in a studio and you have employees doing it, that's one thing. But, you know, when you're an independent content creator and you're in a studio like I am in a spare bedroom, you know, it's the wife is like looking at you when you're going to mow the yard. So, and that's kind of my twist on the editing part.
Well, there is room for both kinds, definitely. Yeah. And I've heard some lightly edited podcasts that are wonderful. But, you know, it's my background. I feel that editing is an important part. And I, in fact, I don't think I've ever listened to a podcast where I'm not sitting there thinking, that could go, that could go. Yeah, that could go too. Yeah. Even our own.
Yeah, Andy, I totally agree with you. I mean, I spent a lot of years, my wife and I did, doing a lot of post-production on our radio show. And I think if you come from radio, I think you tend to think a little bit more like that, though radio typically is a lot alive, right? But it's the discipline of getting to a clock is what gets you in that mental mindset. And that's exactly what I had to do with, you know, with my show. I had to edit each segment of the show for my satellite syndication down to the second. And so it forces you. I mean, so we would spend like 6 to 8 hours on a 60-minute weekly radio show in post-production. And if you listen to the audio that we have, I mean, I have a lot of the archives still available on my website, but you can hear a lot of fancy transitions and sound effects and music and all sorts of stuff that was kind of blended into the content, right? And that takes a lot of post-production. You think about it like a serial, or you think about, you know, some of the shows that Slate does. There's a lot of post-production kind of fading in, fading out, you know, bringing in other conversations, you know, and all that stuff takes time.
Yeah, it lasted about 5 episodes.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the good thing is, there's no right way. You can do it whatever way you want.
Yeah,
that's the beauty of this. You know,
yeah, it's making the content that you want to create for your audience. If it makes sense with the audience, that's great. But you also need to be able to justify the time investment. Because I know, you know. Fortunately, our show that I did for years and years paid us to you know, to actually do it. Where a lot of podcasters are not getting paid much at all. So.
Yeah, they're making gas money. Some of them, you know.
So. Yeah, that's true.
Well, that's, you know, it's I think as we look at the space as it's shaping up, though, I see a lot more refinement in websites. I think the thing that used to drive me absolutely, I mean, I would just shudder. I would go to a website and it would just be this plain Jane vanilla envelope website with, maybe lucky if it had a banner and maybe some, it just killed me. And now we're also seeing people doing, you know, taking a little more time, you know, putting templates together, adding some context. But still, there's a lot of podcasters out there that don't even do the metadata part that's important that gets them found by Google. And so I think we got a ways to go on that. But it's better than what it was. And sometimes they just have to be told. Sometimes they just don't know. They think iTunes is it. That's where we got to be, and that's where you send people.
I'm curious, Todd, do you see a lot of conversion from website to podcast? Do you see people getting a lot of listeners from search and from their own websites?
Well, you know, I can only take my case in point. I was a blogger before I was a podcaster, and I wasn't a very good blogger. I think that for my site, I probably, well, I get 25, 30,000 hits a day from Google alone. And, you know, from what I see internally on my site, I probably pick up 100 listeners a week or maybe more just from my website content, because they come, because we're still creating tech content. We're not just doing the show. You know, if I bring up my site, it's, you know, it's intermixed with content. And, you know, there's an article, you know, that one of our writers put up about the Kindle. So, you know, people come in and read that. And there was my previous show on, and then it's just, you know, some stuff about the cloud. And so, you know, it's intermixed in there. So people are going to say, what's this? And if you're lucky, they click on it. You still have the high bounce rate, you know, that you normally do. But usually what I find is on when people click in from Google to an actual podcast episode, the hang time on that is really high. So it gets their attention. You know, if they come in from Google to that page, you know, usually they come in, they look at something, they're out in 30 seconds or, you know, a minute. But usually when they land in a podcast page, they may stay 5 or 10 minutes. That tells me that maybe they clicked play and sampled while they were doing something else and hopefully subscribe. But I think having the blog content for me has been critical to my show's success.
Yeah, I've seen some success with podcasts getting listenership off of you know, apps and websites, and shows that have gotten some success in a greater way off of iTunes, surprisingly. So I do like to see that. I mean, it's rare, and I think it depends on what kind of genre of content and how strong that show is on social media. The other thing I'm starting to see is Twitter and Facebook, I think, maybe moving, or specifically Twitter more than Facebook at this point, that there's they were on track, I know, a couple of years ago to move towards having more media in Twitter, right? Being Twitter as a media company per se. But I have seen them do kind of the embedded audio stuff now that you can make. They have like a toolkit, it's SDK or whatever, that you can embed players into your Twitter posts and things like that. I just wonder though if we're going to see Twitter become a source of audio and video content, you know, with kind of almost like a catalog or something. I know they played around with a little bit with that with music, but I'm not sure it was done right. I think it needed to be blended into the account experience that people have, or where people could even subscribe or can favorite shows in their Twitter accounts. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I definitely have seen some news come out about Twitter that they might be thinking more along those lines as a source of getting audio and video content. And maybe they'll get it right this time. I don't know. I mean, have you guys sensed that as well?
Yeah, it's definitely moving in that direction. I think you're talking about the audio cards. Is that what they call
exactly,
it on Twitter?
The audio cards. Yeah.
Where you can, especially on a mobile device, play some audio directly from Twitter and then keep doing other things while it plays in the background, which is a great advance. Okay. And I guess we shouldn't be entirely surprised, because the guys who founded Twitter had a podcasting company or a podcasting site before that. Odeo, you probably remember.
Yep.
So I hope that it gets friendlier, but I still think that so many of our users listen to podcasts when they're doing things away from the visual part of the screen.
Right.
That, I just think there may always be an impediment to getting a lot of people to go from reading to listening. I think the use scenarios are different enough that, you know, we still see most of our new listeners come from people who are already listening to other podcasts. And this is one of the points of Panoply, actually, because the easiest new listener to get is one who's already listening to something else, that we think that is the way to go.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with that. I think there's a certain amount of discovery that happens when people come to the website, but I do also know the value in that cross promotion. It's, you know, it's very, very evident. I think you have to have both. It's the folks that are running Lone Wolf that have the bigger challenges because they really don't have anybody to partner with. So I, you know, it's always good to find folks in your genre, people that shows that you like, and try to partner up with them and cross promote. I think it's podcast 101 is what that really is. That's something people should always do.
Yeah.
You know, do you see though on Slate, you know, you guys have a big web traffic, obviously. Do you see then people, you don't think you see the pickup of audience coming from Slate that is actually say, oh, they got podcasts, let me check that out too. You don't see that crossover very much? Oh, or?
Sure, some, but not as much as I would like. There are still people who are regular readers of Slate who don't even know that we have podcasts. You know, we could probably do a better job promoting them, but we exist kind of in a slightly different space than the website itself. I'm not complaining to have the connection to Slate, and I think that most people who listen to our podcasts also read Slate. It's not the case that most people who read Slate listen to our podcast. If it were, we would be bigger than Serial. I mean, Slate is a big site, and right. I wish I could convert, you know, 10% of the readers. But again, it's people are doing different things. When they're reading Slate, they're not really, you know, I think people don't like to generally sit at their computer and listen to things. Mm. Some do, but it's a mobile technology. Yeah. Podcasting, I call it the first mobile app because it was a mobile app before there were mobile apps, as you guys mm-hmm. both know.
Globally, though, I think from and I'm not going to quote any numbers here today because Angela's going to have to update that data, but there's still, you know, globally a large number of folks are getting the podcast via the desktop. And in some instances, that's actually good because of the black hole of Apple. Data goes in and a lot of data comes out. But I think that, you know, we're still seeing, and it's obviously shifted more and more and more as people are, you know, largely connected with, you know, smartphones. And I think, too, yep. that we all know that people, you know, from the beginning have always listened to us in the car, in the commute, in the gym.
Yeah, isn't it like it's still like 40%+ of listeners consume in a browser?
It may not be that high, Rob. I don't want to. Again, it's been a while since we updated those numbers. I don't have them in front of me, so it's probably a good exercise for us. But 35-40%, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I think we did a recent survey, and I think it's a little less for us. I think we're about 70% mobile now.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wouldn't be surprised with that at all. I think it's going to continue to shift too. It's going to continue to slide.
Well, it's the numbers are going to slide, but I suspect that it's more due to growth in mobile than it is to diminishment. The, you know, people who do listen on their browser like to do it, and I'm happy to have any listener. But it is probably a better mobile experience than it is sitting at a desk.
Well, what we do see is definitely a web-based browsing, typically 9 to 5 or a web-based listening is much, 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 much heavier by many magnitudes from 9 to 5 when people are in their cubes or at their desk and they can run, you know, a window and basically maybe be plugged into the computer headset, versus using their mobile phone and using the bandwidth. So I think that's maybe the 9 to 5ers that are, you know, working are the ones that are tuning in. But I also wonder, you know, it's, podcasting is pretty personal, so you wonder how much productivity is lost when they're listening to, at least if they're listening to my show, I would hope that they were concentrating.
So, Todd, like I think we'd be a little remiss if we didn't mention The Infinite Dial came out this week.
Do you have a link to that, Rob?
I have it downloaded. I don't know that I have a link right available. I think you can just do a search for, you know, The Infinite Dial 2015.
Why don't you give us a dive on that? It was talked about quite a bit at the the IAB meeting on Wednesday or Thursday. Go ahead.
Yeah, and they had, I think Tom Webster did a presentation, you know, a webinar kind of presenting the research. Right. It was done in conjunction with Triton, and it showed that the audience for podcasting had gone from 15% in 2014 to 17% in 2015, I believe, is what it said. It's still loading on my computer. I'm doing too much on my computer right now. I think it really gave a boost in perception to the overall podcasting space, around what is happening in the space. I mean, a lot of it isn't a big surprise. It's like we've always said, Todd, it's a trend line that's pretty much been going upwards for many, many years. And you can see that in the data. It's pretty consistent. I think we had a dip or two, in overall listenership in the research, you know, a few years ago. It's been pretty much a steady climb. And if you contrast that to radio, radio's on a steady decline, and online radio is starting to really grow and do well. And I think those are all stats that are pretty consistent, I think, with the perception that most have in the space. The only exception would be probably, you know, a lot of people in the media think that, you know, that somehow, you know, we went from 15% to 30% or something like that in 1 year, if you contrast it to the theme of a lot of articles that are coming out in the space right now.
Well, one thing too is that the percentage of weekly listeners was dramatically up, and it was something like, you know, if you look at the percentage increase, it was like 30 or some percentage increase just in that particular, you know, that column of the information. But it's, you know, it's not surprising to me, the information that was on that study. You know, we've been doing a lot of deep digging as well. That, you know, we're trying to, number one, we're trying to really figure out, okay, what is the true size of the space, you know, look at some of these trends as well. Luckily, I've got the digital data to back that up. I don't know where they pull most, probably surveys is where they get most information, right?
Yeah, I think they sample, I think it's like 2,000 people to get their kind of take on what their behavior is around this. And yeah, it's still loading up on my computer here for some reason. It's taken a while.
I have a couple of interesting demographic notes that I took out of that report. One is that 52% of podcast listeners have over $100,000 income. Mm-hmm. The average listener consumes 6 podcasts a week. In our recent survey, I think it's even a little more than that. And 45% of college grads have listened at least once to a podcast. 45%. That, you know, nearly half of college grads have listened to podcasts. That's a pretty big number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I had Rob and I talked about it last week. I had a conversation with a production company out of New York. Anyway, the guy that was talking to me was 25, and he was, you know, basically doing fact finding for a big media buyer. And the thing that surprised me when I asked him, I said, so are you listening to podcasts? Because really that 18 to 25 range has been mostly missing. And he says, recently, I started listening to a lot. And I said, I'm really into it right now. So there's a breaking point, I think, in the maturity level of folks that makes them subscribe. I think it's going to take a while, or maybe a different type of program to get that 18 to, you know, that 24. But I think there's bright hope for the 25 and above, which really will, you know, if the 25-year-olds are coming in like they say they are, then... Man, oh man, thinking 10 years what that's going to do. The space is, because it'll be this ramp up effect, really.
Yeah. Well, I have some anecdotal evidence on that, which is I have a 15-year-old daughter, and she and all of her friends were absolutely riveted by Serial.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's about a high school case, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, they would get online and talk with each other about it. And also, you know, I'm sure you know this, but the audience for Welcome to Night Vale is largely teenage girls. Hmm. So there are some particular big hits now that are bringing in a much younger audience. And I think those people are going to be looking around for other things to listen to now.
Yeah.
They may not listen.
I think that's a great trend line. Yeah.
I don't think they're going to listen to stogies like me doing a tech show, but entertainment shows and stuff like that will be a lot of fun for them, I'm sure.
I think you need a young female co-host, Todd.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Matter of fact, my daughter and I were talking about that the other day. She's trying to figure out what she's going to do with her life. And, you know, she's got some dreams. I'm like, you know, we should set up a blog for you. Something I can do, you know.
So the research just pulled up on my screen, and it's showing that from 2013, it was 27% have ever listened to a podcast. And now in 2015, we're up to 33% in 2 years. So that's approximately 89 million people have ever listened to a podcast. So
I think it's pretty hard to miss. Everyone is talking podcasts. So people are, there has to be, you know, a certain amount of that that people are like, okay, I've heard this thing about 100 times. Let's listen to one.
But yeah, I'm sure you guys have had the same experience I have a few years ago when you would be at a dinner party or something and say to someone, oh, I work in podcasting. They'd look at you like, oh, you poor guy. Yeah, I remember that used to be a thing, right? And now suddenly it's like, oh, podcasting. Oh, yeah, I know about that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You work in podcasting? Now they want to know, you know? It's funny.
They start talking about cereal, so.
Yeah. You know, I guess it must be in Hawaii. I don't think, you know, I don't hear in my circles here, you know, we all saw the news, but I don't think it had as big of a draw. I think it's a local thing, but it definitely was huge. The question is, are they going to be able to pull that off twice? Are they going to be able to come up with the next case, I guess, for a better word? Are they going to be able to do it, have a twofer?
They're awfully smart. I think if anyone can do it, it's them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Todd, I think that there's millions of people just waiting for the next one to come out. And when it does, they're just going to pounce on it, you know, is my guess.
Yeah. We ran a companion podcast to Serial. We started a few episodes in, but everyone around Slate was talking about it so much. We said, hey, let's just move this discussion into the studio and do it in front of microphones. And it became, the companion podcast became one of our biggest ever. That's how big the phenomenon was.
Mm. I've never done one of those shows, a writer show, and I've never done a show about a show. But
well, this was very meta, a podcast about a podcast. And then someone, I'm not kidding, did a podcast about our podcast, about that podcast.
Oh, man, it's crazy. Okay, so I guess here, and we're almost at the top of the hour, so I know you have to go, but any really last words on, you know, what you guys are going to do and, you know, what the future holds? And, you know, obviously you're building slow, but I'm sure the podcasters are out there thinking, how can I be on your network? Is that going to be possible for the average Joe to join?
Not at first. We want to pace ourselves. This is a marathon, not a sprint. And we're mostly working with partners now that already have scale in some way or another in their existing audience, just because it feels like the smart move to us. We need to build shows that are going to pay for themselves and have a built-in audience. To the extent we can. I hope that as we get bigger, we're going to be able to take more chances on people who don't necessarily have an existing audience, but who we feel could build one. And I definitely want to do that. I also really want to experiment because I love how many different things podcasting can do. When we started, I was throwing everything I could think of at the wall, including we did a couple of guerrilla audio tours. We did one of the Met's Modern Art Collection in New York, and it was our art critic who was kind of irascible, saying, you know, this Picasso has no place being on the wall. It stinks. And, you know, not your average audio tour. And I loved it. And the people who did listen to it wrote in that they loved it too. But I think we were too early. This was in the iPod days, and it was so difficult just to get it there that it didn't quite work. We didn't get the numbers that we needed to do this heavy production. But, you know, I think this could be a time to experiment with something like that again. We're going to try as many different forms as we feel the medium can sustain. And I'm having more fun than I've had in years.
Well, I think Rob's Skype connection died. We lost him there, and he'll be back in. He was sound like his computer was acting up with it loading slow. But one thing I'm excited, you know, about that I saw on your guys' website is that the brand advertisers that you're displaying gives me huge hope that you know, these companies are going to continue to ramp up their spend levels. And you know, and it'll become just another line item on their insertion orders that they'll be sending over to companies every month. It's just, you know, it's just a thing. And I think once we become, you know, for a better word, just a thing on their line item, that it's really going to help the space as well, because the money is important. Without the money, the space doesn't move forward. So as much as people cringe about, you know, talk about the advertising, it's, I think the future's bright for it.
It is, yes. We're really getting a great reception now, especially in the post-serial world where people, I mean, the fact that MailChimp, most people know it as MailKimp now, simply because of that mispronunciation at the beginning of serial, shows how much a brand can get into the public consciousness through a podcast. And I think that was not lost on many advertisers.
All right. Well, very cool. Well, I wonder what happened to Rob. He just completely fell. Let's see if we can call him.
Unfortunately, I do have to drop off.
Okay, no worries. And but thanks for coming on, and I definitely appreciate he's trying to connect. We'll see what happens. But, yeah, thanks for coming on, and good luck with everything, and we'll definitely catch up with you in the near future.
Great. Thank you very much, Todd.
Thank you.
Say goodbye to Rob for me.
All right. It doesn't want to answer. Well, I'm solo here, so this is probably where one of those editing sessions would be good. And we'll see what happens here. Maybe Rob will dial back in here in a second. I do want to, as we've got a little break here, while either Rob's rebooting or whatever's going on with his computer's happening, I do want to talk just a little bit about the new Media Expo that's coming up. And you know, it's really going to it's really shaping up to be a great event, and I want all of you to consider coming out to Las Vegas in April, and really hanging with all of us. You know, it's basically a great week just to come to Vegas and have some fun, and at the same time come to the show. But April 13th through the 16th at the Las Vegas Convention Center, I'll be there with my team in a actual booth. We're actually going to be there talking with the podcasters and other folks that are attending the show. But with the NMX co-located at the NAB show, and for those of you that are not familiar with the NAB show, I should probably load their website. You're getting really a huge value by coming to NMX. You're going to get automatic access to the NAB show, and to be able to walk the floor and see the mega vendors that are there with the you know, basically a booth that runs 100 by 100, and you know, and all the cool gear. They've got a lot of cool keynoters that are coming. John McAfee's going to be one of them. That ought to be a entertaining one. But everything really kicks off Monday, April 13th through Thursday. And there's going to be lots to see, lots of sessions, lots of great catch-up time. It's basically a big family reunion for that week. So we definitely want you to come out. You'll see on the New Media Show website, we've got a banner on the website. All you got to do is click on that, and that'll basically get you a promo code locked in, so that you can save some money on the ticket. If you want to come to the sessions, there's, you know, various levels. We definitely want you to attend the sessions so that you make your time at the show worthy to learn what's new in the space. I'll be speaking. Rob and I will be doing a super session as well. I believe that's actually on Tuesday. don't know what's going on with Rob. I'll text him and see what happened here. Rob Greenlee. I'm going to do a question mark here and find out what's going on. He's probably had to reboot. But anyway, the New Media Show will be on, and we're probably recording one episode there, and we're going to actually start working on that here shortly, who we're actually going to have on the panel. Of course, the panel that we're going to be on the Super Session will include Rob Walsh from Libsyn, and be basically talking about the state of the podcasting space. So, computer crashed on me. That's what he just texted me back. So he is rebooting his machine. Oh, man. Strike one for Windows. And of course, I got to knock on wood here that doesn't happen to me. But it's very, very cool what's going on with the Panoply folks. And I probably just pronounced that wrong again. But obviously, they're going after big vendors or big companies and big brands at this point. So maybe a little disappointing for some of you that are independent content creators. We're thinking, okay, am I able to get my show on over there? And probably not at this point. So, if you look at that advertiser list on their website, it is an exciting time. If you look at Acura, Bing, Delta, GE, Hyundai, Lexus, you've got Paramount, Prudential. You know, all these are big companies, big brand companies that are coming in. And, of course, it's interesting that they have on the bottom, they've got all the direct response companies, Audible, BookSub, Blue Apron, GoToMeeting, Harry's, Hulu Plus. And we're actually going to be running some Harry ads with a bunch of podcasters soon. We've had probably... Well, a lot of podcasters signed up that's going to be running Harry's here directly. And if you're not familiar with them, we'll save that until they actually are a paid sponsor. But, well, Rob, does it take that long to boot a computer? I think he's got one of those slates, too, from Microsoft. So we'll have to tease him a little bit when he gets booted. I think I wanted to wait till Rob got in to talk about the one of the other major announcements today. So I think it's good to have him in here to have some context. So we'll wait for him to pop back in. Do want to mention that my team, here he comes. Perfect timing. Well, that was interesting, Rob.
Yeah. That was a crash, is what they call that.
Well, that was a crash. Did you get a blue screen?
No, it wasn't that. It just the whole thing just froze up on me, and Skype decided to close. So it was like, okay, what happened here? And then it was just a struggle to get back up again.
Well, Andy. Had to leave.
Yeah, had to go.
Yeah. So he said thanks. And, but I've been trying to cover here with, out much content for the last 10 minutes.
Well, you can wing it. You're totally used to that.
I'm
right?
I'm used to doing it, but I wanted to save a topic that we probably wanted to talk about here till you got in.
Yeah.
And that topic, of course, is the Triton announcement.
Yep.
So I want to hear your thoughts. I'll let you go first.
Well, listen,
first of all, if they haven't heard,
yeah,
Triton announced a partnership with Edison, and they are going to do something in podcast stats. So, metrics, measurement. So,
well, yeah, I think probably the best thing to do is kind of back up and give a high level view of what's actually happening in the space in this area. And it's not specific to Triton or the Edison folks, it actually includes Nielsen too. So you have, a lot of these folks, a lot of these companies or, research companies that have really been focused on television, streaming, radio, and radio to support with, studies and research, just like we saw with the Infinite Dial that came out this past week. So they've been supportive of podcasting. I mean, at least the Edison folks have been supportive of podcasting for many years. You know, Mr. Tom Webster has been involved in the podcast community for a long time. So there is a, you know, a connection with podcasting that's longstanding. What's new is the folks that are on the streaming radio side, who typically have been playing in that space for many, many years, are now seeing, you know, on-demand radio has a future that they need to connect with and they need to get involved in. And that involves Triton Digital, which is a company that's been doing ad insertion technology for the radio industry and has been kind of considered to be kind of the leading metrics provider for the online radio industry for many, many years.
For streaming. Right.
Yes. And is kind of the backbone of places like small places like Pandora. Right. So they are a huge player in the online streaming space. And then you look at folks like Nielsen, who I would say everybody has heard of them. They've been involved in, you know, online ratings and broadcast ratings and things for many years, and on the radio and TV side. So they are seeing this as a up and coming medium, and they're jumping in and seeing if they can add some value. And they're also going to partner with some other back end technology providers that can start gathering data and create some more solid data streams, not just research, but really solid data ratings. So you get the Edison folks, which are primarily around survey research. That's what the Edison folks primarily do. And they're also partnering up with Triton, right? And so they put out this joint research project. But Triton also wants to be in the ad insertion business as well. So you have, these companies that have been traditionally in the more of the radio side are jumping into the on-demand audio side, which includes podcasting. So I wouldn't say that all these companies are focused specifically on podcasting. I think what the focus that they're all shooting towards, and this includes even companies like White Orbit, is another player in the space that are involved in the space from the perspective of on-demand radio or on-demand audio is how most of them are looking at it. They're seeing it as just an extension of their current online radio streaming products. What is different about it is that they are looking at podcasting as a downloadable medium as well. And in some ways, that's a mixed bag for those guys. The whole download side is like this voodoo land of metrics and tracking that they haven't been able to get their heads around. And they are working to try and figure that out. And they're seeing a lot of players in the space that have a long, you know, kind of a long history in this. You know, Raw Voice is one, Libsyn, PodTrack. And so there's kind of... there's two groups involved in this right now. There's these new guys that are coming in that have big corporate presences, and then there's the existing podcast hosting and distribution platforms that are out there right now. And what we're seeing, you know, with the IAB is kind of a mm-hmm. coming together of that, right? So that's to kind of set it up from the big picture, and it didn't have to come from you, Todd.
You know, the you know, the thing that and there's a lot of ifs there. And a lot of challenges there. And I don't even want to really discuss the challenges that they're going to have because I'm tipping my hat. But they have a lot of challenges to be able to do what they want to do, from a data standpoint. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Well, I mean, Todd, it gets back to how is an audience measured? Right.
Yeah.
The methodology? What's the key glossary of terms?
Right.
What's the criteria for tracking a play or an impression or a download? I mean,
let's not use the word impression. Impression is.
I know you don't like it, Todd, but yeah. The problem is that those other guys, the Triton and the Edisons and the White Orbits and stuff, they're going to be pushing impressions.
Well, an impression is a lie.
That's what the radio industry wants to hear, and okay. There's $17 billion in advertising revenue.
Well, an impression is not what you're getting with a podcast when you're downloading it.
I know. That's okay. You're cutting to the heart of the discussion that's going to be expanded upon over the next 6 months.
You know, and it's, you know, in the long run, here's what it is. There's room for plenty of players in space.
Yep.
There's going to be players that are going to serve the podcasting community at large. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be players that are going to serve the big companies at large. Mm-hmm. You know, I can almost guarantee you that a Triton solution is not going to be affordable. That's my prediction for a general podcaster.
And a lot of these companies have positioned themselves to play with very large broadcasters.
Right.
So their tendency is to want to partner with the biggest players in the space.
Right.
And that will be where they focus. That's not necessarily a bad thing. That's yep. just, that's their approach.
And it
will be what they primarily do.
Because I'm sure it costs a lot of money to do that.
Yep.
So in the long run, they're going to try to spin things, and I'm going to say that nicely. They're going to try to spin things the way they want it to make their numbers bigger. And in the end, we will see how it all comes out in the wash. And that's basically all I'm really going to say. I welcome competition. I think competition's good because it brings out good discussion points and allows for nice papers to be written and commentary to be made in an official capacity, which I'm not ready to do it.
Yeah.
And
I
you
mean,
know,
I think Todd, I mean, I think backing up and looking at it from the 30,000 foot view, I think these folks bring with them a lot of radio expertise and a lot of relationships with a lot of broadcasters.
Sure.
That is going to carry a lot of weight. And
well,
and I think and that's the challenge, is coming up with a compromise based on what the history of podcasting is and what they see as the vision of what can be expanded upon.
Here's the pure facts of the matter. This is a digital space, and it is made up of digital data log files. And that nothing can surpass that. Nothing can usurp that information. There's plenty of ways to measure engagement. You know, engagement can be done via survey.
Mm-hmm.
Post campaign response stuff can be done via a survey. But you have to be in that digital path in order to be able to correctly digitally measure. And I'm not talking about digitally measure an injection and then say, oh, it's delivered. Count me one up on the board. That is not necessarily, in my opinion, going to be 100% of a reporting solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the IEB meeting in Las Vegas.
Oh, it's going to be very good.
That's coming up, where all these groups are going to get together and throw stuff up on a board and come to some sort of a kumbaya of agreement. I think if that can be pulled off, I think it would be good for everyone. I mean, I think that maybe there's the only way to get there is compromise on both.
The key is there doesn't have to be compromise. There's no such that's not even a word that should be being used, because compromise means allowing something to be invade the space that's not 100% accurate. Compromise means that a solution is that everyone agrees to terms, measurement, basic filtering techniques, reporting, how that's going to work, you know.
Well, I think that there's going to be some different approaches that are going to be offered there, that I think, you know, all of the approaches and the standard presentations or whatever that's going to happen here need to be thrown up on the board, and everyone needs to objectively look at them and say, is this accurate? Is this accurate? Is this true? Is this accurate? And what's going to make the advertiser community confident, right, in what's being offered, right?
I think
that's the big picture.
The big picture really is what the advertisers are worried about is fraud. Fraud is the big thing right now. Media buyer that I talk to, what fraud prevention do you have in? What fraud? So I think we have to be very, very careful, and companies have to be very, very careful on how they're going to be reporting data. The last thing we want is media buyers to think that information that is being shared with them and being billed against is fraudulent. And I'm not saying that is happening. I'm just saying that is a huge, huge, huge piece in the media space right now. And, you know, I think the meeting at the NAB for part of the IAB podcasting working group, you know, I think once you get the tech heads in there, you know, they're going to talk ones and zeros, and I don't think it's going to be as bloody as what you and I both think it is.
No, I'm not going to. I don't think
it is either. Yeah. But I think also that maybe some of these groups that are approaching things in different ways are going to have to realize that maybe their solution isn't 100%. I don't think any solution is 100%. You know, until Apple decides to play ball, you know, there is, you know, a huge percentage of this metric data that's going out that is, you know, going into the ozone. You don't 100% know whether or not a downloaded media file was played later. And yeah. No one can overcome that. Nobody in the space can overcome that yet. And
well, I think that is a point that should be established in the industry that we try and overcome and improve upon. And I talked to a few people last week and on this topic came up, and I think it's going to be critical to try and approach Apple to get them engaged in these discussions too. And I think that there has been some talk that Apple may show up for this meeting. I can't confirm or say who or, you know, if that's going to happen or not, but there has been talk that that could happen. I don't know that there would be anything that would come of it, but Apple is such a big player in this.
Yeah.
That it would be in the best interest for the whole podcaster space and industry or whatever you want to call it, to have them at the table, and somehow be able to contribute, to this playback issue that has been plaguing the industry for ever since I've been involved in it.
But the thing is, it's not necessarily been plaguing. We're being very successful in executing campaigns when the media was largely downloaded, and it's still a high percentage is downloaded. The only thing is,
I'm talking about play data that comes from when an episode has been downloaded.
Oh, I know.
If it's played.
Right. But the problem is that, you know, the thing is we've worked around that for 10 years, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think, as long as we know what that number is the important thing. Daniel says in the chat room, I can only see Triton succeeding if they control the player of the media hosting. That's, Daniel, probably a very good point. And I will just say about that. Now, you know, in to their defense, and you know, I'm not gonna badmouth them, is that they have to. Oh, besides the fact that they talk to us quite a little bit, they have an injection system. So yeah.
Well, that's been their business on the streaming radio side for years.
Yeah. Yeah. So they, you know, they're measuring on the injection, and so that's where they kind of, you know, they fit in. There's probably more to it than that. I shouldn't understate that, but you know, and it's a, you know, it's a proven system. So it's not necessarily, and it's something. I believe it's a system that's trusted. So they wouldn't be a player in space unless they didn't have that. So let's not. I don't want to imply anything different, but I think what we all need to fully realize is that the, you know, the podcasting space is different. You have media everywhere. You know, you literally have it on, you know, thousands of different locations.
Well, let's back up and look at how these companies are looking at this space, because I think it's important to give perspective on, you know, Triton and folks like White Orbit, and those are coming from streaming.
Right.
Okay. So I think that's a key thing for us to think about here, is that these players are, or these companies are going to look at this space as content, and they're going to look at it as an on-demand stream. That's how it's kind of like.
But you it's know, not the majority of it's not on demand.
Well, no, that's true. They've lived in a world where radio stations have been streaming live, yeah. Right? And then there's this entrance that has happened with Pandora coming in with personalized streaming radio stations, right? So that's pretty much as far along as they've come, right? Sure, there's services out there that can play a track, right, as a on-demand stream. And that's been going on at, you know, iTunes and Zune and Xbox Music but you look at Spotify and you look at, you know, other places, Pandora, that's primarily been just a streaming thing, right? So what's different here, and that's what these guys are going to do, they're going to come in and look at this as content, and they're going to want to offer metrics to encourage more streaming. That, you know, you look at Spotify, you look at these other players that are coming into the space that are taking on podcasting, and they're going to want to apply the same thing that they've always done, and that's streaming.
But fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on what seat you're sitting in, the podcasting space is different.
It is, and that's where this translation is having a struggle.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, if you look at the iTunes numbers today, it's 3/4 to 2/3 download versus streaming.
Right.
And I don't know if that trend line is going to continue stronger towards streaming or not. The data that I've seen hasn't really, it's been pretty stable from what I've seen. It's not like shifting dramatically over to streaming, and I'm not sure if it will or what's going to cause that to happen or if it will ever happen. I don't know. Do you have a thought on that, Tom?
Well, from an on-demand standpoint, you know, we're doing on-demand now, you know, and if you want to call that streaming, that's fine. Let's call it on-demand. So, you know,
basically the user experience. You hit play.
But yeah, that's still being served from a server somewhere. And unless the guy has big money and it's being served from an injection server.
Yep.
You know, and the 97% or 98% of the podcasters out there are not using injection. They're not serving from an injection server. They're not, you know, let's be very frank. It's the, you know, the big picture. You have the folks at Podcast One, they're using injection. You have, you know, some other players out there, big players that are, but that's a small subset of the big pie.
Well, and not all shows, even at Podcast One, use ad injection. Oh. So it depends on, I mean, it's usually the injection comes from, you know, a particular type of advertiser that wants to run a particular type of campaign on a particular program.
Right.
And it tends to be advertisers that typically advertise on radio.
Yep.
That want to play in this space. And so that's where the ad injection issue comes into play. I think if you were to talk to Andy at Slate, he would say, you know, we're not really into ad injection, right? There's kind of this difference in content providers.
And that's why I said in the beginning, there's multiple players in space, and there's going to be two or three different ways to skin a cat. And Triton's going to bring their piece in on their the piece of the pie that they want to try to skin the cat on. And, you know, that's going to, it's going to fit a certain subset, and that's, you know, going to be great.
Yep.
You know, that's fine. It's just the way it is. It's how it's going to work out. But I think what we need to make the podcasters that, you know, the majority of the podcasters listening to this show, is this going to affect them? I think with the IAB involved in trying to work on with this tech committee that's going to be meeting at NAB, I think that from that will come a better understanding on both sides. But I think at the same point, you know, people are going to try to change the language up. And I think if they change the language up, it needs to be well defined, because the last thing I want is a media buyer thinking that they're buying banner impressions and using some sort of dart tracking, which is, you know, again, associated with banner ads and not well suited for measuring, you know, the media delivery. It sure tells you when the ad went in on a media delivery, but it doesn't really tell you the full scope of how much that media file was downloaded, how much of it was streamed, where it came from, where it went. It doesn't give you that info. So, you know, there's going to be different solutions, and some media buyers are going to be more confident in one than the other. We'll see where this leads to.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair to all sides, I mean, it's a good thing that these big players are coming into the space, because it's going to bring more revenue opportunities. And I guess where this needs to happen, I think that the, you know, Triton and others that are coming into this space that are relatively new to the space are going to have to learn the school of hard knocks, just like you have.
And we have, I mean, and I'm not saying that we're not open to learning too. You know,
I think both sides probably have something to contribute, and unfortunately I do see it as two sides. I mean, I do see two philosophies here that are coming from two different distribution strategies and monetization strategies, but that kind of do blend together, but there needs to be some translation that happens for it to fit together properly.
All I care about is 1 + 1 = 2, not 1 + 1 = 6.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, in the end, is all I care about. I've said from the very, very beginning, and any of the partners that we talk with, any of the companies that we're having Explore talks with, that 1 + 1 = 2 and not 6. And I don't care what the number is, as long as I know what the number is. And that makes a lot of people nervous. You know, and it's, you know, what can I say? It's the philosophy that I've always followed. And, you know, you can't get from point A to B with digital media. And digital media, I think the thing that I love about this, and what makes me kind of be able to rest easy at night, the digital data can't lie. You know, that's the main thing.
But it can vary a lot based on how it's parsed. So
not really. It's still delivered the same way. It's, you know, the media bits going out are media bits. And, you know, that is, it's still in a log file, relatively the same data.
Oh, as far as raw data.
Yeah.
And how CDNs parse it. But it is a human decision about filtering. Yeah.
But the filtering stuff is easily defined and easily.
No, it is.
And
no,
easily. I guess for a better word, easily argued should be filtered, what isn't.
And that's what needs to be done.
You know, and just on...
Not all players in the space understand all that stuff.
And you know, you look at just took at Twitter alone.
Yeah.
There's probably 100 filters that have to be applied for traffic coming from Twitter. You know, and how many companies do that deep a dive and actually look at origin source, and, you know, what directed that origin source? Was it a human? Was it a bot? Was it an indexer? Was it a scammer? Was it, there's lots of different things to look at. So, you know.
Yeah. And this is an issue that's been, surrounding display advertising too, and
Rob, here's the thing, that, and this is my new saying, the only people that have problems with measurement are folks that don't have measurement. No, it's true. The only people that are complaining about measurement are those that don't have measurement. I'm not getting any complaints on measurement from folks. Yeah. I'm not getting complaints from measurement from. But yet you read articles and people are complaining about measurement. Well, the people that are complaining about measurements are working with networks that don't have any measurement. So it cracks me up when I see those comments in news reports and stuff. You know, the reason these folks have issues with measurements is because they don't have any. And they're kind of going by, you know, guessing, maybe, or, you know, light sampling of a data set. So,
well, I mean, if you think back, I mean, what's interesting about this is that the radio industry hasn't really had, I mean,
well, they don't have to be measured.
They've been basing their stuff off of ratings and based on surveys.
Right.
Because there was no way for them to, those radios that are out there that people use or tuners to listen to radio, it did not report back when a person tuned into that station. So there was no data coming back, right, on when that connection was being made to that radio station and at what point in, you know, what time of day or anything like that. So there was no source of data. So now with podcasting and on-demand media, we have sources of data, you know, and that's what's different about this.
Right.
And the streaming side has gotten us a little bit closer to that, right? It's been able to capture deep data on stream duration, you know, actual counts of people that are connected to those streams.
Mm-hmm.
And so the radio industry has been getting this stream of, like you said, digital data.
Right.
But yet the surveys are continuing to happen. Mostly the surveys, based on my experience, and you probably agree, have been mainly focused on things like what we saw this past week with the infinite dial. It's been around, you know, percentages, and because there is no kind of like reporting that happens in a significant way in any of these mediums where all of the companies involved in the space all report into one repository of data to get actual hard figures on these things.
You know, one thing, you know, and that's something the NAB is starting to collect now. They started collecting revenue totals last week, but you know, I think the thing that I think Tom probably gets mad at me over Edison is that, you know, he tries to, and their data is great from a big scope things, but I really, you know, where I have issues with is them trying to determine an individual show size with data from surveys. And it's pretty black and white to me coming from a tech side on, it's not that complicated, you know, to be able to see what, at a very, very basic minimum level, what the minimum number of folks have actually even touched that file. I don't know. You guys in this show have heard this 100 times, so maybe I'm beating a dead horse here.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't yet have a guest book for next week. So,
okay.
So we'll play by ear. I've been kind of booking it based on what's happening in the news.
Yeah. And it's, that was a good call this week. Yeah. We're already here. My God, we're an hour 38. So,
I could try and get, you know, Tom Webster on or somebody like that. At some point, maybe we can talk at a deeper level with, you know, on this stuff.
That could be dangerous. And he may be under NDA now, not to say what they're going to do either, I would imagine. One thing that we'll definitely want to do is we'll want to get some folks from NMX or some of the speakers on, so maybe we can work with that team and get some of their podcast presenters on the show.
That's what the vision was, right?
Yeah.
And I think we're all kind of set with our session at the New Media Expo as well. I think it's going to be at 11 a.m. on April 14th. It's going to be a super session, and it's going to be you, me, and Rob Walsh.
Okay. Should be a lot of fun. And to answer Daniel's question, yes, we will be making some major announcements at New Media Expo, and along with our partners that are involved in the announcement.
Oh, good.
So... yeah.
And I think that the podcast awards are now open for votes.
Yep, voting's
right?
Going on. Yeah.
Yep.
And so that's exciting. And as a matter of fact, I've been dealing with some people having a hard time voting, so we were looking at it. But, Daniel says, I suggest interviewing someone from PodClear and from Tykra, T-R-Y. You can see it in the chat room, Rob.
PodClear?
Yeah, they're another company that's basically got a double ender solution.
One other player that I came across this past week that's involved in podcasting too, I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're based out of the UK. They're called Audio Boom.
I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah. They do have a podcast hosting solution.
Okay.
And they seem to be a pretty big player on the music side.
Oh, okay. It's interesting how these music players are also doing podcasting stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I guess they just signed a big deal with Russell Brand. And so he's now doing a podcast on their.
Who is he?
He's a kind of a music. Yeah, he hosted a very popular radio show on BBC, I think, One for many years. And then he's come to Hollywood and LA and has been an actor in a bunch of, movies and things like that.
Right.
So he's got a pretty good following. He's kind of a crazy guy. I mean, anybody that really knows of him would say that. And he's had a variety of podcasts, over the years. So he's a pretty big name in the UK. So anyway, it's another player in this space, that is jumping in, making podcast feeds and making things available, kind of similar to what Spreaker is doing. And I think we may see some improvements coming out of Blog Talk Radio, So,
yeah, they've been working on their stuff for a while.
Yeah. So there's a lot of new players coming into the space and getting involved.
That's good.
Yeah.
And
it's all good.
All right. Well, I think we're pow hana here, as they would say in Hawaii. That means we're finished.
Okay.
So you can reach out to either Todd or Rob at newmediashow.com. If you have a guest suggestion, please email us. And if you have comments on today's show, we'd like to hear your feedback as well. There's probably some good juicy stuff in here for you today to talk about. But anyway, thanks for showing up and being here. And for those on live, thanks. If you're listening later on demand, we definitely appreciate your continued listening or viewing of the show. Rob?
That's great. Yeah, I appreciate you tuning in and listening to us banter back and forth. This is an important time in the podcasting space, and I know that we have a lot of podcasters that listen to this program, and I just appreciate you being here. And if you want to follow me online, I post quite often at Twitter. I'm at Rob Greenlee. So
at Geek News is where you can reach me. And everyone take care. We'll see you next time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Aloha.